Who's here at the review panel for the first time? Ah, yes, several. Excellent. So for your benefit and to remind the rest of us of the format, its simplicity itself, we the panel, and hopefully you the audience too, have had a chance to go and see four current exhibitions in the Greater Philadelphia area. We show a PowerPoint of the first two. We have a little discussion about it. You the audience let off steam and let us know what you think, and then we repeat the exercise and then we go home. So that is the review panel. The next one is in the spring, but just plenty of chance to follow all the info on Twitter by checking in at the PAFA website or by visiting artcritical.com, where we will also be hosting podcasts, recordings of the past. By then it will be six review panels, and all subsequent ones will be recorded and posted there. Now, my great pleasure is to introduce this evening's panel. Alphabetically, and from my left, your right, Astrid Bowlby, who has already been introduced, the panelist has been named by Jeffrey. Astrid Bowlby, who is a professor here, on the faculty here at the Pennsylvania Academy, is an artist. She's shown internationally, and her most recent museum exhibition of Substance was the a drawing installation at the University of Southern Maine, a piece that's actually been bought, even though it's a performative piece, you can nonetheless, you can, it seems, buy a performance, and the piece has been bought by the SEI company, the SEI company,
SEI.
The SEI,
West Collection.
West Collection. Excellent. And Ariella Budig is an art critic of the Financial Times, and Philip Glahn is, who perhaps, if you have a very good ear for accents, discern, is a German-born. Philip is associate professor at the Tyler School of Art at Temple University, professor of critical theory and visual art, and he is an expert on, among other subjects, art and activism, and has a book coming out from Reaction Press next spring on the subject of Bertolt Brecht. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome your panel. Great. So, panelists, we're just going to turn around and duck our heads a little so that we can join the audience in seeing the PowerPoints of the first two exhibitions. So when we collectively pick the shows that we want to discuss, there's very little thematic planning that can really be conceived ahead of time. One has the choice that one has of what's going on in the city, and one picks on the question on the basis of what seems like the strongest show, and or what seems like the kind of shows that will spark the best energy on a panel discussion. Then the pieces fall into place, and it's as if some big hand up there, not the invisible hand of the market, but the invisible hand of curatorial affairs, suddenly determines, okay, let's give Philadelphia, the review panel, a show in a beautiful, exquisite building on three stories that's one of the sort of old-time marvels of the cultural scene in Philadelphia, with international Chinese husband and wife, Chinese artists, one at Lee Song Gong, an international star, doing things with manipulated and found objects. And let's also give them a 16th scaled down model by a group of young artists collective in Philadelphia from a huge warehouse in a rundown little art co-op, the smallest probably in a sort of rundown building of art co-ops, as if to be some sort of weird contrast in scale in every sense. What sort of vibe did we get going around the city and seeing those two shows for Ariella and I? This is from New York on the same day. No doubt for you others who've had a chance to separate your visits, but nonetheless, here we are thinking about the two shows at once. We'll soon get down to the business of thinking about them one by one, but I think it's worth a word, worth a thought about the sheer serendipity of what's going on in these two shows. Any thoughts on along those lines, Ariella?
Until you said it, I hadn't really even connected I hadn't made a connection in my mind thematically between the two shows, but they actually are about home in some sense, as things in spaces. I'm not articulating it anymore, but just thinking about your question.
They are both about histories in a strange way, aren't they? About their own. Song Dong and Xin have obviously their work is work that's seen elsewhere and is brought to Philadelphia, but the men's and women's bathrooms are site specific. But their show seems to be very much about the disquietude and the kind of the melancholy, sort of strange nostalgia for poverty that animates the life of the post-revolutionaries, as they're called, the young Chinese who grew up post-1949. And then the guys from Traction reducting their own space in a tiny space. They're one of the biggest co-ops in Philly, physically, recreating their recycled materials, using the recycled materials to recreate a place that uses many recycled materials on a smaller scale. So it is about history and place and particularity.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that one of them is the one at the Alliance was sort of permeated by nostalgia, as you say, and the other one seemed very forward-looking and kind of optimistic and charming. I mean, without this kind of weight of commentary on world events and bullet shot mirrors to signify the collapse of civilization. I mean, that show had so much symbolism, kind of almost allegory. It was so heavy-handed in so many ways. And the other one, Napoleon, was just so charming and enchanting, and you just wanted to, in the way that as a child you're delighted by toys and dollhouses and miniature things, it kind of spoke in that language of delight. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very sad.
Yes, yes. Well, possible further comparisons, Astrid and Philip are welcome to bring in as we discuss the two shows, but I don't necessarily want us to make it a compare and contrast job, because I think it's rather unfair, perhaps, to the Chinese artists who are competing against something that just has a very intrinsic charm to it. And it may also be unfair to Traction to allow charm to take over from the seriousness, perhaps, of what they're also doing. So let's focus our minds on the two shows, one by one, starting with the Philadelphia Alliance. I'm excruciatingly embarrassed not
Can
to
I
memorize the name of the artist. Yin Shu Zhen is the artist's name I was struggling for. Philip, yes.
No,
I just thought that the idea before we move on from the comparison actually thought was quite interesting, especially since you mentioned, and I know it's been in the text, but this idea of the post-revolutionary.
Yes.
I don't know, now this is for the first time I'm really thinking about it. I thought of them both in a sense about this question of collaboration, right? I mean, the Traction show is very much put forward as a collective effort also. The collaboration amongst the two artists, or three artists, including the daughter maybe at the Art Alliance. But are they in a sense both post-revolutionary forms of collaboration? I mean, yes, it's more charming, with the track to show, but in terms of kind of producing an idea of collective or collaborative labor in art making or something like that, how invested is it really? You know, what's the kind of perspective onto collaboration in these two shows? I actually thought that was quite interesting. Mm-hmm. What's at stake, right? I mean, what is, it seems nostalgic, right? In one, and not so nostalgic in another, but, you know, are there different things at stake necessarily?
Well, I think, I mean, there are so many issues brought up by that because the traction collaboration is an actual collaboration. And what I felt when I went to the Art Alliance was, I'm going to make my stuff, and you're going to make your stuff, and then we're going to put it together, and we're going to hope it means something.
I totally agree.
And I was like, I'm not for that or against that necessarily, mm-hmm. but it's a very different feeling. And the traction piece, I really felt like the setting of it within this building that is affordable because it is falling down around them, and filled with other creative endeavors, was almost like a brain inside a brain. And so when I stood outside the Vox building after I saw that piece, I felt differently even about the whole space. And so for me, it was very much more a specific moment of installation, whereas at the Art Alliance, I felt like that was an opportunity lost, where that building could have actually been a very strong collaborator with the two artists and their daughter, and it was not utilized as effectively as I felt it could be.
Did you think that the restroom part worked?
I almost turned around and left. not because I didn't want to walk through one door or the other, and I walked through the male door because actually that was the closest one, but I felt like, oh, I see, I'm going to get hit over the head with a hammer. And I was, over and over.
I had never been in that building, oh. So I got to the top of the stairs, and there was this wall. I didn't know what to do.
Uh-huh.
Right, that's interesting.
I actually thought it was a restroom.
Well, that's a sign of a very powerful and effective and successful installation.
Yeah, I walked in and there was that chandelier, and yeah. I thought, well, no, and then I walked back out, tried the other door, but I actually thought it was a little bit like this surreal moment. Yeah.
So you thought there were restrooms and you went into the men's toilet. That's interesting.
Right. Yeah. No, I actually went into the actual restroom.
Yeah.
And there was a woman in there who told me that a man had come in the night before thinking that was part of the exhibit.
That was his excuse, yeah.
But isn't it interesting? I think that the idea of collaboration with that actually means, I think that, you know, collaboration is such a, it's a word that has so much traction right now. But you know, it's being used everywhere. Art is social practice, you know,
yes.
I think that a lot of people actually, we kind of use it as a shorthand, but not necessarily always think about what it means.
So yes.
Participation and community and so on.
Right.
And I'm really kind of interested in the way that it plays out differently in different places. And while when you said that one was a real attraction, was a real collaboration, yes, I agree with you in a sense it was, but then the question is, like, what's the quality of that collaboration? Ultimately, it's a space, but everybody does their own thing in that space, right? When it comes to art making, it's collaborative in another sense.
No, I think to ascertain the facts here, that the traction, and I haven't been to the space, I'm now bursting to go there. My Philadelphia friends were encouraging me to see it first, but I was pleased to see the show, the model of it, with an innocent eye, so to speak. But my understanding is that it's a workshop where artists pool their resources but make their own work, and they came together to produce a work in part of the citywide project, so that the Napoleon Collective would be showing at Traction, and Traction would collaborate on one piece. I think for the first time that all the artists in that collective came together to make one piece for Napoleon. So, Philip, when you say that, when Philip says that he wonders about the post-revolutionary aspect, I don't think a socialist collective is the only reason for artists to form a collective.
No.
Artists form collectives for economic expediency, but also the revolutionary aspect, one could say, of the subtraction is its ecology. and the ecology is a new revolution. It's not going to be necessary. When a new revolution comes along, it doesn't have to ape the look and feel and rhetoric of past revolutions. In fact, it usually isn't a revolution if it does. So.
Right, right. Even more good reason then to kind of discern what it means to be collaborative, collective, etc., yes. etc. Right? Because those terms come with a certain
yes.
ideal,
yes.
right, and certain
yes.
ways. Yeah.
Did you think that the whole installation was undermined by having that piece that their daughter did? The one
the film upstairs?
No,
the dog hair. I actually thought that was the best sculpture in there.
But did you think, but then didn't it sort of undermine, I felt like, okay, you're just going to put your dog,
Describe it for us, will you?
It's a chopstick. There are three chopsticks.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only one with three, because one of them represents her.
Right, and one of them looks sort of like a gun, a sort of silencer on a gun without the gun part.
Right.
The other, and it's made up of a remote and a GPS.
Mm-hmm.
And the GPS, the test panel tells us that the GPS is so they'll always know where their daughter is. Or something like that. Something to do with the daughter kind of being out in the world. And
yes.
The other one was a musical instrument if you attached it to the back of
a car. Right. It's
so
like
an elongated
and
off
one. It has holes in it that you would be able to play if you were a giant. And then the third one is, I just remember the hair on it. I don't remember what's underneath it.
It's a chopstick glue with the dog hair glue on
it.
Her dog. And she asked to make a chopstick. She wanted to make one. So her parents have been making chopsticks. She wanted to make one, and they let her make one. Actually, I think that's a really meaningful collaboration in a way, because they opened themselves up to allowing something to occur and then seeing what was going to happen without deciding everything beforehand. And they didn't want to do it. She
right.
had to talk them into it. And so that I really appreciated. I also appreciate the idea of a collaboration being able to be two people coming apart and then coming together. I appreciate that. I actually think the piece at Napoleon, it really has nothing to do with the meaning that it was made collaboratively. I think the meaning is incredibly about a person in that space coming to grips with what's around them. That is clearly handmade, but I'm not sure if it matters if I know that Billy made this, Lucia made that. This is, I don't need to know that. I have not been to Traction, and I did not miss that at all when I was in there. So I'm not even sure that the collaborative aspect of it in any way adds to the meaning of it.
For the Traction.
Yeah, right. I don't know.
That was what I think we take different cues from, how we see it. When I was there, there was somebody standing outside, since there was a line and you could only go one-on-one. And she was one of the artists, and she was very happily and very enthusiastically telling me about this, how this was a collaborative project. And I thought it was great, right? Because there was something that people made together. It was
yes.
like this idea of overcoming a sense of isolation, kind of maybe, as old-fashioned as this may sound, this idea of like artistic individualism that we still,
yes.
I mean, you had an art school, I'm an art school, it still is the pervasive model,
yeah.
right? And I'm not sure that the collaboration, I'm not saying that the collaboration of the Arts Alliance is more successful, it's a different one.
Yes.
And I'm kind of curious about that also because, and you're right, I think one of the interesting things about both of those spaces is that we're very much in the observer position, or like in the midst of, and this was pointed out to me, I didn't take credit for this, but that, at the Art Alliance, I felt very much like I was almost in a natural history museum.
Mm-hmm.
How things were displayed very close mm-hmm. to the ground rather than on plinths, long wall texts with explanations. It seemed like I was an outsider looking in. Right?
Yes.
And I thought that was actually very interesting. It was almost like an observation, a study, because what I don't know much about post-revolutionary China, especially not any experiences of it. So it's implicated in a very, very different way.
I think I'd like to take up Astrid's critique of the chopsticks show and the way of chopsticks. Because actually, we see it used to be a very prevalent subtext for exhibitions, and to the point where it got to be rather cheesy, and it doesn't take place, only takes place in commercial galleries, really, the husband and wife show. But it seemed to me that this is not just a husband and wife show. They actually very actively have collaborated. It is a piece by both of them. What's kind of very causal and sort of down the line is the husband doing one half, the wife doing the other half, and then the toilets are really kind of dramatizing that gendered binary of how the wife will, the husband will give us window frames and the wife in some contrasting strategy in the split furniture. Ostensibly one more masculine, one more feminine. Did that work, Ariella, or did that detract? How did the gendering of this division work?
I mean, I felt like that the art, every single thing that I looked at in that show was about something else. So, you know, the stockings were about something. Even if I hadn't been told it, I mean, I don't think it actually mentioned it in the text, the fact that it was female stockings, the fact that it was, but that was part of the overall sense that I had, that the whole thing was not itself, but really about another thing. And so whatever I was looking at was kind of this meta experience of, this is a chopstick, but it's actually really about this. It's about, dissolution, or it's about, what China was like when I was going to court. But none of it felt real to me. It all felt like it was sort of like a textbook about something, or like I said before, an allegory for something else, instead of something that I experienced directly with real emotional resonance and didn't feel in the show, except the sort of very generalized sense of nostalgia. And I think in the video, that came out in the worst way, because it kind of had this sort of very over-the-top symbolism of the stuffed animal and the filling the clothes. I mean, it felt very heavy-handed to me.
And it was much too long.
Yes.
A bit MTV-ish as well, right?
Sort of, yeah.
The future.
The music, everything.
But if you think it's a spirited device of
I also have problems with the show they lay elsewhere. But I wasn't a big fan of the video. The most interesting part of the video to me was actually, I don't know, I wanted to take everything with a little bit like a grain of salt, as if I was being presented with already a stereotype, already like it was almost nostalgic about nostalgia. It was post revolutionary. What does that actually mean for me? Like that I see the split screen and then there's this child, and is that, you remember there was a little piece of paper that said if you were to make a movie, there had some questions that you could have. If you were the viewer, and one of the questions was if you were meant to make a movie about the future, who would be the main actor? I don't know who that would be, but I wouldn't put a child. The child is a problem, I think. What I thought was most interesting about the video, and I go back to this idea of like how I was positioned, was at the end the video had a curtain, and the curtain had this little I don't know what it's called, like fish twine, how you pull it open. And I know a lot of it was felt staged, but purposefully so. And I thought that to me was the most interesting part. I thought it was very, I don't know, like you said, maybe overly emotional at certain places. But for me to kind of create an awareness of myself as this person that, I don't know, there was no real position for me there. Like, I wasn't really integrated, I wasn't really outside. I don't know, I was constantly pushed around to these different vantage points.
I think part of the problem for them was how incredibly beautiful, at least especially on the ground floor, the Arts Alliance building is. It seemed to me that a lot of their strategies, sculptural strategies, were very much recycled in a non-ecological revolutionary way from things we've seen so much of before. All the proliferation of mirrors was very Christian Volkansky. The furniture split in half of concrete added was very Doris Salcedo. Even the stockings wrapped around a little bit Sarah Lucas. So, I mean, we sort of, it's the kind of stylistic recycling, which seems to have a different status in contemporary Chinese art than other kinds of contemporary art, was very gnawing on the nerves for me.
Can I just say that I don't know if you guys saw it or if any of you saw it, but at MoMA a few years ago they had this piece of that. In that huge
Yes.
That was also all about objects that had been collected and
by the
artist's
mother.
Yes. I can't remember the name of the artist.
I am terrible with Chinese names. Song Dong, it's the same artist.
It's the same artist.
Yes.
That was so much more successful.
Yes.
Than, I didn't realize it was the same.
It is the same artist, yes.
That was incredible. Because just the sheer accumulation of things, and they were just objects. Nobody had really done anything to them except lay them out in that sort of
magnificent way. His mother had been a rat packer, with like an obsessive compulsive rat packer, but growing up during the privation.
Was about the things. It didn't have that sort of meta meaning of, you know, it was just here they are, these are the things she had, and I'm going to show them to you. And
especially as they followed on in the footsteps of the Martin Kippenberger, which filled the same space at MoMA, an accumulation of office desks and such objects. It seemed to become the way to do things in MoMA atrium.
I just felt like they didn't use the space very well. I mean, the place that it worked best was the second floor, where it was most like a straightforward exhibition space, with the exception of the bathrooms. And I don't know. I mean, I felt like everything they were trying to say to me was very heavy-handed, and that the objects were illustrating ideas that I was getting from a text panel. And to me, that's like, you know, failure with a capital F. So I tried to really feel the things that they were trying to say to me, because of course I can tell they're sincere, but as far as a thing where I go to have an experience, I felt like materially it wasn't good. I mean, I stopped on the stairway at that little chair at the landing, and I thought, that's something right there, and in that space, that's something. And that got me, and there were a couple of moments for sure. Maybe the other video with the two hands, there was an intensity to that that was almost unendurable. That I thought that was pretty strong. But in general, I was really, the downstairs I felt like was filled with too many things that repeated the same motif over and over. And maybe that was the intent, and somehow that was lost upon me.
He seems to be a very uneven artist, because he is capable of really tremendous things. The MoMA installation we just mentioned, but also his last show at Pace had for instance, the three mountains, it was called, and based on one of Mao's sayings, but much more focused and kind of intriguing and dynamic, kind of both sculpturally and also conceptually.
I have no idea why that happens. I have some suspicions. I mean, I saw a show of Olafur Eliasson at Arcadia University once, and I thought, oh, you didn't give 2 cents about us and this space.
Oh, right.
It was really crappy. And so, you know, I don't know, maybe people
are
stars
like, this
phone it in, because it's just Philadelphia. Who knows?
Well, perhaps one of the effects of the review panel in Philadelphia would be to make international art stars think twice about not sending their best work down here.
Are we going to get to talk more about Traction?
I would like to move on to Traction. Let's now focus on the show at Napoleon. And had I only but known, or if I'd read the press release properly or whatever, it would have been wonderful to include in the discussion the Napoleon Collective show at Traction, and within a marvelous sense of symmetry, because what we see when we go into that room in the far left corner is in Redux, 1/16th scale, the actual Napoleon show that is out there in West Philly at the Traction building. So we've got this amazing, put your hands up if you would, if you managed to see so far the show we're talking about now, Subtraction at, that's impressive. And if you're in the one-third of the audience who hasn't yet, I for one would, I think most of them would urge you to take it in. It's quite an event. So most of us know, we come from the videos, we enter this kind of dollhouse-like space. It's 1/16th the size, that makes you really marvel at the gargantuan dimensions of the original building that it's modeling. And but then has a fastidious detail of using recycled and unlikely materials, some of which we can now discuss and describe, actual objects that can be found. It's a very literal portrait of the warehouse out there in West Philly. So we've already touched on the issue of collaboration and ecology, but what was the sensation of the show, and do we begin to have some sense of a feeling of what it might mean? Astrid.
Well, I was pretty blown away by it. I was a little bit worried that I thought I would just love it because, you know, I love the people that made it. But so I tried to go, I first went in like that, like, some of my friends made this, and I'm going to look at it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, look at that. I recognize that. And then I'm going to go away and come back, and I'm going to just be a person, try to be a person that came upon this thing. And I actually really liked it better the second time. And I went in and I actually sat on the floor. There's enough room for you to go in and sort of be in it as if you're a Gulliver or something. So I just sat on the floor for a long time, and the light in there, the whole feeling of the space is very realistic to what that kind of space would feel like. Like if you went to a big warehouse space and there's some skylights. And it's really a tour de force of the feeling being recaptured, not only the objects. And then you just start looking around at everything, like, how did they make that, and what is that? And as a maker, I felt very, very comfortable in this space, even though it was gigantic. Like, oh, I'm inside my brain, my making brain. It was really great. I just loved that so much. I thought it was a tour de force.
Yes, Philip.
And it's only one. It's 1/6, not 1/16.
Yeah. Oh, I see. I repeated. I thought we had 1/6. Okay, thank you for the correction. Yes.
If I thought it was a tour de force, or just in general,
or what sensation you had looking at it and what it might mean.
I hit my head, I think. So that was pretty good. But I liked it. I thought it was, in the sense that you said, it was marvelous. I mean, it's something that you marvel at, and I was impressed by, you know, kind of the idea of this replica of this one-to-one scale, and the kind of effort that goes into that in terms of time and in terms of labor and this kind of investment and so on and so forth. I was curious about, like I said, I thought mostly about the collaboration part, but we can table that. But I was also curious about what am I looking at, in the sense of it's a kind of like a, it was both to me like a wunderkammer, right? Like a what's it called? Yeah, wunderkammer. No?
Yeah, we call it wunderkammer. Wunderkammer.
And it was a miniature, right? This idea of like being able to see things from a different perspective, and, you know, have a different glance onto things, being able to navigate a space differently, and I thought that was great. I wasn't sure exactly what it is that I was then navigating. What was I discovering? What was I seeing? And, you know, I think that there's this, I don't know, it struck me that there was a kind of a sensation that I felt when I see things by Tom Friedman or Tim Hawkinson, about this kind of, like I said, almost obsessive compulsive way of making things and the kind of bravado that comes with it. But like I said, once that perspective was there, I was kind of curious, like, now that I am this giant and I have this other perspective, what am I looking at?
Yes.
You know, other than the actual things.
And Charles Lejre might also come to mind as somebody who obsessively works small for loaded reasons that have, in his case, to do with labor. Ariella, I was also thinking of Joe Figg's portraits of artists in their studios. He does these sort of dollhouse reduxes of.
I don't know.
Joe Figg is a New Yorker. I'll introduce you to his work someday. Yes, he's a character for sure.
Do you like those Joe Figg pieces?
I marvel at them in the same way I do this piece. I mean, I thought this. I loved being in this piece. I'm not sure it's a stupendous work of art. I think it's a great thing. I was going to say, but in fact, Ariella and I said, walking back from the show, we had to see it together this afternoon, that we should, perhaps the panel might this evening want to petition the Philadelphia Museum to buy it, because it really is such a document about artists' life in Philadelphia. But it could almost, it doesn't have to go in the art department, it could go in the doll, it could go with the period rooms upstairs, couldn't it?
It's, well, I think your description of it as a portrait was a really, really apt description. And in that way, I was thinking of it a little bit like the Chomp Loy pieces that people make where it's the objects brought together in an oil painting and that represents a person. And from that level, I thought that it was a work of art because of that. And it really brought it in a way that I feel like most Joe Fig pieces don't. So I feel like it's in a different category because of that.
Oh, okay. I'd say it's most certainly a work of artistry. And I don't personally attach as much significance. I don't know why I'm even following this line of thought, because I just come to despise the whole no categories of art and artists. We should just talk about things and people when they're interesting.
It's my fault, because I said tour de force.
No, that's fine. But I think that...
I think the question is sort of, can you just go into to see something and have this delighted response and just think that it's marvelous without having to sort of overlay, an intellectual justification for it? I mean, you go there and you think this is so wonderful. And does it need to have that extra layer of, well, it's really about this, or it's really, we need to sort of bring a kind of intellectual rationale to it. We can't just appreciate.
You know, it's a funny thing because, Philip, I don't know what, I think Ariella is actually laying on the table a sort of fundamental aesthetic philosophical problem. I mean, it seems that we have so much. We're still very much in an era of highly conceptual art, even though the heyday of conceptual art seems to have fizzled out, and to some extent, and we're back into making things. But this sort of dichotomy between something made with skill and artistry on the one hand, and something having a transformative profound meaning on the other. This dichotomy should have dissolved by now, and yet this, somehow it stays alive always.
Okay. I first of all, I don't think that's the kind of dichotomy, at least that's not one that I would adhere to or would set up. Then I would also wonder why it should dissolve. Simply because it's old or because it's a passe thing?
And because we want art, that's both. Because we...
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why it should dissolve. It should dissolve because of our greed for art exposure.
Right. I don't think it's about deep meaning versus the other thing. I think there are different forms of pleasure to be had. I don't think that there needs to be austere, and I don't think it needs to be about meaning or kind of the idea that intellect is something that you overlay on top of art. To me, at least, I would want art to do something more complex than something that is...
What can I
think? Not art, meaning maybe like in terms of popular culture or entertainment. Entertainment, for example. Entertainment, I go and I say, hey, that's great, that's entertaining. When I go to art, I think entertainment art's fantastic. Yes. But I'm kind of thinking like that.
Are we saying, Ariella, everyone, are we saying, panel, that in a way, this is a great craft piece?
No, I don't think that it's that different from going to see The Girl with the Pearl Earring or. I mean, I'm not making an analogy really, but do we need to know what it's
skill.
About? Or the goldfinch, that the Donald Hart novel is about. It's a bird, painting of a bird in a cage. It's not really, you could read lots of things into it, but really it's just a picture of a bird. And it's a beautiful picture, and you respond to it, and you respond to the virtuosity of it. It's nice to know the context is. But I don't think that, you necessarily need those things to...
Yeah. I don't know, but maybe then that would go into the place where what's art got to do with it, no? Or what is art? And, I don't know. It's just that I think that, this is relatively new for me. I mean, I have a very slow learning curve, maybe, but teaching at an art school, teaching mostly fine art students, there's this, me not being an artist, there's always this kind of idea of, like, what's it actually doing? And the students want to know, why am I making this? Why should I be making this? And does this actually matter? Does it actually matter something than other that's simply nice, that's simply pretty? Like, those are the kind of questions that I get, and I think those are valid questions. They want it to matter. They want to be engaged in the struggle over perception, visuality, and meaning. They don't want to assign meaning, but they want to contest and contend. And I think that's actually a very valid thing. So I'm not saying the traction thing is all crap, not at all. And I think actually, if I were saying that, it would be short-changing. Because I do think that there are a lot of things in there that are very problematic. I do, for example, think the dog, and then I'll stop. The idea that, you know, you said maybe it should go in a museum, maybe not even the art part. And I was thinking, yeah, maybe it could go with the other places that have dollhouses. But what do dollhouses do? Dollhouses somehow give us an insight into, right? They take the wall away, but they also kind of make cute the site of domesticity that's maybe not always that cute. You know what I mean? So something happens when you do something to that scale. And that's where I think it gets interesting for me. That doesn't have to be attached to it necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I think if the work goes there...
Here's a comparison to throw out. One thing I was thinking about when I was looking at the skill, the daintiness, the whimsy, the humor, the chutzpah of this scaled down this model, I did think of Calder's Circus a little bit, and but then you see Calder's Circus to me is a great work of art. It had precisely a sense of demystifying this young American in Paris entertaining the avant-garde with this wacky circus thing. But then when you see it within the context of his whole career, it really is the linchpin that lends itself to one of the great sculptors of the 20th century. And I think then that sets a yardstick when we look at this piece. Is there an equivalent there of the dynamic, the whimsy, the sort of raucous humour of Calder? And I'm not answering the question negatively or positively. It's not a rhetorical question. It's a genuine question. I think there is something there that makes it profound in the way that it's and it has to do with the materials rather than to do with the actual forms.
It's okay. Go ahead. Well, I actually. That's an interesting thing to bring up, Calder Circus. I didn't really thought about that. I think the piece at Napoleon is more serious, even though there is whimsy and charm in it. I actually feel like it is very, very serious, made by very serious makers. And there are some whimsical elements, some whimsical ways they solved things, but that it was a really particular decision that they made, an event they put in motion, and they did not get off it. They brought it all the way to the end. Now, you could say, Astrid, that's because you're an artist and you make stuff and you went in there with a different sense than somebody else would. And I'd say, for sure, don't we all? I mean, I think that's fine. I mean, but that's my take on it, is that it was a very, like a caring, loving, kind of serious and very difficult thing to do, to get all... Is it 14 of you? 14 people together to actually do that thing. And I'm kind of interested in what will happen to them as a group because they put themselves through this process. I mean, it's an aside for sure.
Yes, it's like an ascent of the mountain. I mean, yeah. It's a group. It must be a group bonding.
And all of the separate artists in it all have different styles. So the thing is that they each had their own style, so it's about, you know, kind of this being able to work, I mean, not to add meaning onto it that maybe isn't there, but I mean, each one of them worked separately in his or her own individual style, and then collectively they made this thing that wasn't in any of their style, and yet was in all of them. And they subsumed themselves into it, and yet if you look at it, you see, I mean, it's sort of a microcosm of the art world. You know, all of the plethora and the sort of variety of ways that people are working now, and there are so many different ways. It's sort of like there is no one way. There's just all of these ways, and here we're showing it to you in this kind of tiny little world, within a world.
I think, though, sometimes that a work of art or a piece, it doesn't matter if it is a work of art or not, it can have real meanings that aren't intended either individually or collectively by the makers, and it's part of the validity, part of the strength of that work, the work that goes into it, and the work as a piece, that others can find this meaning in it, and that it's not us imposing arbitrarily or whimsically or egotistically some meaning that's not there. It is a meaning that's inherent in the piece. So
it's a gap. A gap is set up and people fill it in different ways.
Yeah. Well, let's hear from our audience now on the first two shows we've seen, The Way of Chopsticks and Subtraction. Do we have a mic that's going around? Do we have a person? Oh, yes, we do. Marvellous. So the mic is coming your way. Wait for it, please, but do let us know. In fact, there's two mics. You have a choice of mics. You can be on the left mic or the right mic. So, yes, our president, David. I think you get priority.
So I just wanted to offer a comment on the Traction installation and to say that I think the virtuosity and the mimetic quality of a piece is actually in some ways a distraction from the power of the piece. And I think that that's what you started to get at, Astrid, towards the end, when you talked about the emotional aspect of it, where I think the real aesthetic power of the piece lies, where the artist coordinated their individual creativity to the work of the collaboration. And that I think someone also used the word optimism and talked about home. There's a real love in the piece and a willingness to sort of give themselves over to this team project, where I think the real power comes through, and where it also contrasts to the Joe Figg pieces, which are really more like dollhouses to me than this is. This to me really seems like a group of artists working very intensely, very hard to create a very powerful emotional statement. And it's in that affect rather than in the mimetic quality that the power of the piece lies.
Thank you. So, I need to get you on the panel, sir. Thank you. Yes, actually just immediately behind Twint, I would seem to be working through the hierarchy, but yes.
Well, I was actually thinking similar things to David in a way, but I was going to take a different tack. First of all, I think the conversation about the Traction piece is really interesting, and the sort of the ideas that are at stake there, and that sort of in relation to the like the sort of amazing object. Something that I think is important to think about that was sort of touched on but not talked about that much is the context in which it was made. It's a gesture as part of the citywide exhibitions, and sort of that sort of conceptual seed of I've never been to the Traction Company, and although I know some of them are, or maybe all of them are related to PATH, I don't really know any of them, so I sort of somewhat objective here, but the idea of we're taking our place of work and what we do and transporting it. And there was a real portal quality. I sort of felt like being John Malkovich came to mind when I was there. And there's something about stepping in and being transported to a different part of the city and to a different place, and the sort of thinking about being in that space, thinking about another space, and also the Napoleon work that came to mind was maybe one of the interesting ideas that that was at stake in the piece.
Excellent. More comments on either of them? Any perhaps a spirited defense of Sandon would be appreciated.
Yes. Yeah. I think Phil made an interesting comment about sort of art school and sort of the teaching of having to have meaning behind art, and I almost felt like you ladies, I came a few minutes late, but a couple of comments I caught, it was almost like you were sort of against, you even said something about the exhibition at the Art Alliance being almost too educational in a way, and I actually thought that was an extreme strong point of the show. I managed to make it over to the show this afternoon, and I thought it was an exceptional exhibition. And I thought that educational aspect, like I think Philip even said, an don't know how many of us here know too much about post-revolutionary China, but again, are you guys necessarily against like that educational aspect of art or having a meeting? Because just to reiterate, one thing goes like definitely in art school nowadays, they ram it down your throat that you have to have some type of meaning behind what you're doing. Though at the same time, in the contemporary art world, a lot of the most popular artists completely reject that notion and have no statements whatsoever sort of supporting what their work is about. A lot of people say, I'm not saying anything about my work. So I wanted to hear a little bit more of what you really see that in contrast to what Phil said.
Do you want to take that?
No.
It's okay. It's a very valid question. So here's the thing. When I go to a show to look at artwork, I'm a smart person. And if somebody does something like put an M on one door and a W on another and then make me decide which one to go through, I get it. I get it. It's about identity. It's about control. I don't need a 5-page document to tell me that, right? And in that show, the objects, the things that were made, did not stand up to their descriptions. In other words, their descriptions were hopeful for me. I liked the ideas behind them, but the ideas were not being delivered by the objects. The ideas were being delivered to me by the text panels. And I will give you an example. I loved one of the text panels. The one in the room with the suitcase with the pink clothes on it and the Mona Lisa.
Mona Lisa, yeah.
Yeah. That text panel about the generation of that idea was awesome. It should have been made 5 by 5 feet wide, hung on the wall, and ditched the two sculptures. Because that was the subject matter, that text panel. So that's, I'm not again, I love ideas in art. I'm all over it. I've got a ton of ideas. But the road to hell is paved with good ideas, right? I am not so interested in objects that are illustrating ideas. Write something down for me. Almost all of them. I felt the piece on the landing and some of the pieces downstairs I felt were very intriguing, but I felt it was repetitive and I didn't feel like the things, there was too much, it wasn't arranged well. It felt like the ideas were more important and the ideas were used to invest these pieces with the meaning instead of the way the pieces were made. Not all of them. You and I could walk around and I could probably pick 3 or 4 instances where I felt like things were a little better than that.
Yes, but very good question, thank you, and it could be the subject of a whole panel. There's a gentleman in the second row.
I saw neither exhibition, so I can't comment on the exhibition, but I never resist making a comment on collaboration. And there was an artist from the middle of the last century, Klein, who was no longer really a fine artist, but who was one of the best marketers that I've been in the arts.
Eve Klein.
And he made one beautiful commentary, which fully understood the depths of collaboration. And he stated that he believed that all artists are collaborators, even to the point where they have the right to walk up to any other artist's work and sign it with their own name.
Yes. As you say, a great marketer. Good.
Hello.
One at the back. Last comment from the back would be great.
Hello?
Well, yes, there's also a watch that has a second hand that's ticking by.
She's already got
oh, okay. She got the mic. Good. Let's go for it then. Thank you. Yes.
I thought that the fashion company's art was really endearing to see artists come together without a deal, but I wonder if that stifled the emotional response to the piece, not being able to see their individual ego come out.
Yes, I speaking personally, I'd say not, because I think there can be a collective ego, and even a superego. So I think I felt that the group was bigger than, I don't know the individual artists. I got a sense of some, well, hardly a fair sense, but the vaguest intimation of what they do from the 1/6 scale models of some of their works in progress that I was able to see this afternoon. But no, I think it seems like the group ego is a strong one. It's saying we are a group of people who have pooled our resources, who have this extraordinary place where we work, lovingly making this document of it, and some or all of us have incredible minusculist talent and a kind of whimsy and imagination to take golf balls and spray them and turn those golf balls into light fixtures, or to have an anvil that looks like it, or some kind of machinery that can even work almost. I almost felt that if only the collective had had David Adamo join them, they'd probably have working radiators in that space. But no, I don't feel there was a lack of ego. I think it's just a lack of signatures, maybe, but it's a collective signature. I think there's more to an ego than a name. Let's take one more comment, because there's a person at the back there who I saw. So, and then we'll move on to our next two shows.
I just wondered, you talked about this delineation of gender in the Alliance show, and I was thinking more specifically about when you're a child and you get a present and assigned a gender at birth. It's either a dollhouse or a toolbox to some degree, and I saw this piece in some of the ways in which there's a sense of play that comes together between the genders of sort of prescribed miniatures that little girls are given versus the toolboxes of boys, and whether you saw that that collaboration of gender actually mixing in a way that may not have been as successful in the Alliance show, or whether that didn't really have anything to do with it in your minds.
I mean, I think your comment's really interesting, and I hadn't thought about traction in gender terms, but I think it's really interesting because if I think about it, it definitely felt kind of like a masculine space. Something about the, like you say, the tools and the even the coloring. You know, you sort of think of like girls' dollhouses that have pastel and.
Girls' houses are not usually set in 3,000 square foot warehouses.
Right, but I mean, even something like there's that one that in Chicago at the that dollhouse by the Hollywood Star in the
in the Art Institute.
Not in the Art Institute. It's in the other museum, the Museum of Science and Technology, or something like that. But it's there for some odd reason. Anyway, it's got all of these. Feminine quality, and I think that you're right that the traction piece really does kind of, maybe that's what's so exciting about it, is that it feels like a kind of collaboration of genders, so that it's sort of this kind of masculine space kind of created in this feminine, not style only, but genre, you know. And so it does feel, almost makes it feel even more transcendent. I think that's really interesting.
Of course, the one thing we didn't get in this dollhouse was a doll. I mean, it's a depopulated warehouse, but of course,
there's room for us. That's us.
Yes, we're the dolls. Yes. Fantastic. Something very Ibsen-esque then in that. So let's move on to the second PowerPoint, if we could. Thank you. So Philip, Ina Swansea, artist from North Carolina of Welsh ancestry, seems to have her chief international following in Germany, for reasons that may be banal and not very profound. But I think it may fitting to start with a German perspective on her work.
Yeah, I was, to be honest with you, I saw when I went to Lost Gallery that there was a catalogue from the Deichtorhallen in Hamburg, but I had not known that she had her work exhibited there. But nonetheless, I'll be happy to give you the German perspective. I was kind of struck by the idea of how I felt about the work and how it was written about, and how those things came together and were different. I actually liked the work very much. I liked the work was the way it was hung. It was kind of the strange, kind of these absurd relationships among the work that I felt were most compelling to me, rather than the works in and of themselves. There was a strange sense of I don't know, absurdity, darkness, something surreal. But that strangeness came from a place where I wasn't quite sure whether it was actually how much it bordered on kitsch, and how much it bordered on my perception of what kitsch is, or the reiterations about little children, back to these children, to the children in art, haystacks, landscapes, views onto the Hudson River. I don't know. I thought there was something really interesting. The more I read about it, and you know, got this personal or biographical take on the work, the less I, because then that was kind of the attachment of meaning, of how something means something. So it was less, I found it less compelling. But in the essay, Gregory Volk wrote something interesting about the sublime and the work. And I thought that there was something sublime about the work, but to me it was not so much about the traditional idea of the sublime, like Caspar David Friedrich, the encounter of the landscape, the grandeur, and so on and so forth, but really this idea that the sublime lies or resides with the limits of adequately portraying these kind of emotional subconscious states of longing and fear. Yes. That's, if that makes any sense.
Yes. I think, I thank you very much for that. Yeah, I would just want to just say though that when earlier in the discussion and the question from the floor about it, about this relationship of the work itself and meaning, I for one was never thinking about it being the wall label, the catalogue essay. I mean, fine, we're reviewing exhibitions, it's perfectly legitimate to look at those things, but when I'm talking about what does the work mean, I mean, what do we really get out of our aesthetic experience of the piece? And so with Swansea, I mean, it seems to me that Philip has actually touched on many of the profound meanings of the work. It's it seems to be incredibly and unusually skilled painting, but nonetheless confronts the issues of kitsch and the issues of mediation, what it's like to be in a media-saturated culture where so much of our take of the world is from a screen, or when we see things in life, that life imitates the artifice that's going to probably mediate it very soon, if it hasn't already. So it seems to me, yeah, it's a very slippery medium that she works with, and to rather profound effects. Do you share in that sense, Astrid?
I really, really wish I did, but I don't. I was excited to go to the show. I thought I was really gonna like it, and I had seen some of her work before, and I just kept going from almost, there are maybe three pieces in there where I'm like, okay, almost there. I think the graphite is often getting away from her as a beginning point. The two haystack pieces I think are not very good paintings. The one painting that I think is amazing for the things that you were talking about, like as a tour de force of painting, is the one in the back on the right, of the city, and there's a girl sitting in a window, and the color relationships of the gray and the red and the blue and that pale lavender of the text, all of that, like that, I could sit there and look at that for a really long time. Unfortunately, the figure is pasted on, and maybe this comes to what you were saying about the kitsch elements, or like there's a weird combination in there of goofy and sublime, and I'm not
I you know, that sounds neat. I'd like to go there, but I'm not, when I look at the pieces, I'm not totally getting it. And then there are so many little things like, here are all these beautiful passages of pain, and I'm like bringing it all together, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's like a little bug walking across across the canvas, which is, see, I'm going to remind you, it's just material. And I'm engaged, like, I like that idea, actually, but I was feeling somehow like, okay, you're drawing the top of that pylon with your paintbrush, like, it's okay, I get it's a pylon, you don't have to do that anymore, and I understand, it's also paint, and it's not really a picture. And I just felt irritated at almost every canvas, and maybe that's what she wanted me to feel. I'm not sure. I mean, if I read the reading, it doesn't seem like it, but man, if I read that reading, I'd be like running to that show, and boy, would I be sad when I got there. I read it afterwards.
Ariella.
I felt like there were sort of two shows in that show, and one of them was the New York paintings that you know, I can't look at any other way than, you know, this is in New York. This is a place I know. And I even the one of the snow, which is sort of so abstract, you know, I recognize that. And so I react to those because they're sort of familiar places, and I thought that she captured the feeling of them very well, like what it's like to be at the edge of Manhattan, you know, looking towards New Jersey, or you know, on a snowy day, not in Central Park, actually, as the catalog essay said, I was pretty sure it was also down at some extremity of the city, not in the park, not in the long park.
No, I think it was.
It was in the park? How do you know?
The artist told me.
She said it was in Central Park?
Yes. It's after a snowstorm. I didn't believe it.
It doesn't look like Central Park at all.
It totally doesn't. No, I concur. But,
well, but that's one of those things where I sort of related it to the place, or what I thought was the place. The other one...
She might have been lying.
It really looked to me like Lower Manhattan. Mm-hmm. then there are the ones of... like that haystack with the boy peeing, or whatever he was doing, I don't know. But I just thought, what is that? Like it didn't mean anything to me at all, and I didn't think it was much to look at. And all of the ones actually that had people in them pretty much didn't work for me. I mean, the one that you were talking about felt very like a hopper kind of one.
Yes, it's a girl in a window, or a young woman in a window.
Yes, sort of New York isolation, you know, alienation.
Well, she might actually not be a real woman. She might be a representation of a woman, because or else she was. No, I think it's a parade. It's one of these like Easter or Thanksgiving parade.
The one in the window.
Yeah, don't want to swear to that, but. Yeah, she's like a showgirl of some sort in a window, looking out onto a parade. But then the majority of the canvas is filled with the
Hotel front, Paramount.
Yes.
Paramount Hotel, the building.
The building where many pop songs were written over the last generation.
But anyway, I felt like the one with the three teenagers, their faces. I just thought, you know, I agree with you. It just sort of, it looked like a. I don't know what to make of it, and I didn't know what made them succeed for me, whether it was sort of the fact that they captured a certain mood that I recognized, and therefore I related to them. I couldn't really see them separately from my own experience of the city, and the ones that were separate, they were the sort of Monet-type ones, that just felt kind of like ode to Monet, or, you know, my version of Monet, and then there were the kind of sort of strange ones, like that haystack prison.
Mm-hmm.
Thing. And I really didn't know what that was at all.
Well, I always think it's good if you don't know what something is.
Well,
I think
not in a good way.
Okay, fine. For me, she's. I rate her highly. If you look carefully at the bibliography, chronologically, mine is the first line, the confession of interest. I've been following her for a while. It seems to me actually that she's. Redoing, she's a painter who really is very, very conscious of and very closely looking at the history of painting in the way that all good or intelligent painters do, but she sort of redoes for us some of the qualities of, or some of the some of the effects, perhaps, effects or and or qualities of painting through Manet, through Alex Katz, but post the picture's generation. So she's somebody I think who's like acutely conscious of the social mechanics of generating images, looking at imagery, but seems to want to animate the painting craft with that insight or sensibility. I would defend the Haystacks painting that's coming in for some digs here. I thought that was kind of luminous. It seems that in many of the paintings there's a light motif that unites the New York City paintings with the more bucolic kind of landscape paintings, is this way of using dabs of paint. It's almost creating digits of paint that corresponds to digits that are observed in nature, whether it's the bales or the bricks on the building's facades, or the stumps in the river that kind of at first look like an aerial view of New York, and then on closer inspection you realize are actually in wood piles in the Hudson.
With that painting, when you're talking about it, I actually had was one of those things, almost like a continuity error in a film, where so you look at it first and you see it looks like a cityscape, and then you realize that you're looking at piles, and then you see the birds on the pile. But so at the bottom of it, there's a line, and then there's a shift of alignment of the piles, and I stared at it for a long time trying to figure out why that was there or what that line was, and I couldn't figure it out, and I couldn't figure out any reason for putting it there. And I was wondering if you, do you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. What do you understand why she did that?
No, except that I'm when I would walk around the room, there was always a moment. See, this is, I kept trying to find my way in. I wanted to. I looked at the catalog from the first show they did, and I thought, this is somebody that I would really like this painting. But I'm not sure what's going on now. I feel a little bit like there are some quirks or ideas that are maybe slightly getting in the way, and they're not being made through the paint. They're sort of being put on top. And then I think, oh, well, maybe that is an interesting idea. Like, maybe that's the thing, like, that I'm supposed to be getting to, is that. Like, so the figure of the skier sort of pasted on top of this beautiful, painterly skiing event. And it's just, stuck there. So then that line, I thought, that's a kind of, again, a break that's supposed to somehow let me in or make it feel weird or something. That is as far as I got with that. I'm not sure.
I think I don't agree with you, but I like what you're saying because I think it's very perceptive. And I think she is an artist who works hard to be weird. There's no question about that. I mean, she's I think it's such a consummate painter that she doesn't want to be just another nice, good painter. And it's almost a kind of will to expose the sheer weirdness and the warpedness of the world and to celebrate oddity. So I think that the discontinuity that Ariella noticed, or the kind of pasted-on quality that Astrid is objecting to, these are sort of probably things that she's noticing in either looking at the world or looking at photographs of what she's looking at or looking at the way other painters have dealt with things. There's a lot of art historical reference throughout the show.
No, I would agree, but I would say that not just art historical, I think you're right, but kind of a way of taking into account what the limits are of how to portray certain things, or how to perceive certain things. Actually, I thought it was interesting that it was done in painting, where it could have been maybe you could take a postcard in order to show the limits of, like, kitsch, how to capture a kind of like depth of feeling or this idea. And I thought that, like I said, to me, the kind of what I meant by sublime earlier was this kind of the failure like the failure of the me, the viewer, or the artist trying to, through all these constructs that we have available, right, this whole history of painting and image making, and still that vis-a-vis never quite completes itself. Right, she thought, yeah.
Yes.
If anything, one of the negative things,
yes,
would be that it seems like a very, yeah, it's like a tragic gesture almost. It's like a, you know, almost Richter-esque idea of like the like the failure of painting, yet still this possibility. And I'm not sure I'm on board with that.
Well,
but that's a different topic.
I got the German perspective I was after, so thank you very much. And I would concur that she's somebody who wants to problematize everything she's doing, and so I think in a way she's an answer to Richter, but it's the same. It is the same kind of question: is whether painting is possible? Yeah. So our final show took us back to University of the Arts, like Locks Gallery, a venue we've been to before in the Review Panel, and to the Rosenwald Wolf Gallery, if I'm overly Germanizing the Philadelphia pronunciation, probably it should be Rosenwald Wolf, but however it's pronounced, we went to see Dennis Adams, and I should have said pardon André Malraux's French in the excerpt that we showed from Malraux's Shoes. Ariella, you talked about one of the shows being like a two-part show. We're seeing a show of this and a show of that. Here we literally have a two-part show. We have both Malraux's Shoes and Tagging the Archives. I think we'll probably want to focus most of our critical attention on Malraux's Shoes, the movie. Again, I'll do a little straw poll. How many of the audience has got to see the show so far? Right. It looks like the third who didn't get to Traction. I've been whispered in my ear, how many of you stayed for the full hour? But I won't ask the panel to put their hands up. You stayed. Excellent. Okay. Yeah. Well then, you stayed, so you lead. Not that we're admitting to not staying, but just describe for us all what's actually happening in the film. I mean, literally.
There's a man wearing a black suit and a white shirt and thick black glasses, drinking and smoking.
And don't forget the black shoes.
And the black shoes. Drinking and smoking and walking across reproductions of sculpture. I think it's mostly sculpture, right? And he is performing a diatribe. He is deeply engaged in thought. He is anxious. He has anxiety. He is angry. He's getting old. He's a man's man. Reminds me of watching Mad Men or something. When I went in first, I went to the show twice, and the first time the sound was on, but the video hadn't been set up yet because it hadn't officially been open, and I was riveted by the sound. It's an example of a video that is actually a really good movie, and so often videos are not even approaching really good movies, but I could watch that thing and watch that performance and not know one more whit about what was going on and be completely riveted trying to feel out what this person is doing and their emotions and what they're trying to express to me. Mm-hmm. And the pieces in the front, I laughed out loud like four or five times. I thought they were really good and very economical in their delivery of what they were doing.
Yeah. So it's André Malraux, the great, well, not great, but the French novelist, sometimes socialist, part of the De Gaulle administration, cultural bureaucrat, responsible for all the great regional museums in France, and author of a book, The Voices of Silence, in which he puts forward the concept of the Musée Imaginaire, the museum without walls, really picking up the idea that photography has changes the scale in every sense. So maybe the theme of this evening is scale in making available the whole plethora of images from across time and place in this to modern man, to modern society. But we get something that's odd happening in the soundtrack, in that in one way it's like a historical reenactment, because André Malraux, it's based on a classic photograph of Malraux with all the pages of Les Voix de Silence sort of spread out and able to walk up. He's laying it out and deciding what order they should. He's curating his magnum opus. But actually, as we quickly discover with all the references that we hear in the soundtrack, many of them are to things that are post-date Malraux, or are very contemporary events, and lots of in-jokes about art, for instance. Philip, how much is this a portrait of Malraux? How much is this a portrait of Dennis Adams, do you think? Where is Malraux really in this? What sort of character is Malraux in this action?
I think that he's a historical figure, right? He's a figure who performs and is performed within history. It reminded me very much of, you know, the German filmmaker, another German reference, Alexander Kluge recently made a film, 10 hours, a little longer, about Eisenstein's attempt to make a film of Capital. So there's this, again, this like remove of three times.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I have to say that, you know, the score of the text, it was interesting to hear you describe it, you know, the old man and the frustration. I really thought it was, yeah, I mean, I felt Malraux was somebody who was, Dennis Adams was performing Malraux as somebody who had maybe thinking about Malraux's evolution. What do you do with all these fragments of history? It's frustrating, but it's joyful. At some point, he sways to the music, which is Schubert, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he's frustrated, he's happy, he's ecstatic, he's thoughtful, he kneels, I didn't think he jumps, you know, but he might as well. So I felt that there was something, like, a lot was at stake with regard to the kind of notion of history, collective memory, something that I think Wright describes Adams' work, and this kind of invested really in making something that is as complex as the subject that it looks at.
Yes. Ariella, the jump historically from this very, as Astra says, sort of madmen, kind of the periodicity of getting so many details right of costume and location, and but at the same time with a very poetic contemporary text, interestingly disconcerting. What did you make of that?
I have to confess, I think I'm going to sound like a complete philistine about this one, but I couldn't figure out who the audience for it was. I was sitting there with someone who must have been in his 20s. I'm sure he got none of the references. I got probably, I knew some of them. I felt like it was the most pretentious thing about itself, and it made me squirm. I wanted to leave, and I felt compelled to stay, probably because I was going to be in this panel. I would have left. I thought it was like kind of this kind of decadent academic. I hated it.
I can't disguise my feelings. You know, it's funny because I find myself between the two positions that have been staked out, because it's an image I knew very well, because my professor at the university was a post-war French expert, and so I knew that photograph from the get-go. And then it occurred to me that art history and art schools with great distinguished men teaching art theory, such as Philip in them, are producing maybe a whole, I mean, I don't know, Dennis Adams is a bit older, it's too old to have studied with Philip, but the point is, we're getting these kind of more and more quote-unquote learned artists who are steeped in a sense of history. And this seemed to be a very contemporary piece, because we go, if you were in the Venice Biennale, it was a rather, I thought, one of the best things in the curated exhibition of the Venice Biennale this year was a video by a British artist, Ed Atkins, which is a video that goes through André Breton's studio and lays onto it a text that you think, I was listening to it very carefully because I studied surrealism, I thought, quite carefully, I don't know this Breton text, where is this from, what text is this? And then it became more and more obvious that it was a contemporary text. It wasn't Breton, it was somebody talking, he had done to Breton almost what it seems that Dennis Adams is doing with Malraux, is saying, okay, Breton or Malraux, André or André, are alive now and are steeped in the art world of now and the critical theory of now. So they are relived, they're still alive, and they never died, so they kept up with all the theory and all the art world jokes. You know, that together with, is it Gabriel Byrne or the other Byrne? The Irish artist Byrne, who twice now done, you know, a documentary on Venice, these historic reduxes. He did one piece where the surrealists talking about sex for hours on end was a sort of multi-screen video, and it was a riveting piece, but it's very much, it's beyond art about art. It's really, there's a trope of contemporary art, which is a sort of history museum of art. History. Is this falling into this category, do you think? Or is it a springboard for a really personal?
I don't know, but I think that's actually a very interesting question. Is how popular is art? How insular is it? Right? How self-referential and so on? I don't know. I actually, you know, we talked about this very briefly before the panel, but the song at the end is a Brecht song, or a Kurt Weill and Brecht song. And I actually felt that it was kind of like I do things since it's what I work on. I guess maybe that's why. That what does a Brechtian art piece look like today? That actually looked like one to me, in a sense. That it was about an intellectual pleasure, it was about looking closely, hearing, going back. And I think you're right, I think the audience, at the beginning I thought it's a video piece, why isn't this on TV? It's 45 minutes long, it'd be so great if it's on TV. But then maybe really it is for that specific public, where people go back and you kind of understand. I thought there were references in there that were very humorous. Mm-hmm. I didn't get all of them, but you know, then you can read the script and you can, I don't know, I think there was a lot to say. If history is, what I was trying to say, I think there's complexity that's necessary. I don't think that you could, anything else you would be doing to the kind of complexity that Malraux already brought to history at a structuralist moment, right? Leading styles and all these kind of things that were out in the other exhibition space. To kind of already take apart the idea of that there is a simple narrative, a simple way to look at this, you can't put it back on. You can't just tidy it up nicely and put it back in. So the question is, when you have all these shards, what do you do with them? Mm-hmm. And I thought that's what this was telling about.
I think, well, first of all, I don't think also it can be on a monitor or a TV, because, I mean, the way that it was projected, the floor goes right down to the floor. Like, you're sitting there, and you are like, in that space with him. Like, I felt like that very strongly. And I also kept thinking, it just popped into my head, that there was something about trying to make sense, trying to make a kind of sense out of a complicated thing. Like, there was a core of frustration, of anger, of maybe realizing a futility. You talked about putting shards together and making sense of them. There's a, in either the Recognitions or JR by William Gaddis, there's a whole long passage, it's a monologue, about trying to make sense, about double and triple palimpsests, about ordering things, putting them in a place. And I just kept thinking about that. So for me, as someone, you know, Malraux, whatever, I like all that stuff, it's great. But that was a strong emotion, like it was more than you had to be in the know to have a feeling.
But from my perception of it was that there were two voices. There was sort of the voice of the character in the suit, and then there was the sort of voice over, and their tones were completely different, because the the character was sort of screaming and, you know, frustrated and angry, and the voice was this kind of somnolent, dreamy kind of monotone, kind of going on, and the sort of faces it took away.
At times I thought it was an inner monologue that breaks out into that speech, but at other times I agree that it's a different voice because it actually is asking questions of André.
Well,
a lot of them about sexuality, a lot of it was sort of probing his orientation. And then again, because it wasn't really Malraux, because there's post-Malraux stuff in it, I didn't know whether Adams is constructing a self-portrait, if it's a self-portrait, essentially, because it's him that's enacting Malraux, or so that adds sort of a layer of complexity.
But, I mean, do you think that? I mean, who do you think a piece like this is directed?
Who cares? It's for me. I never ask that question. I'm not on a funding agency. Why would you care? It's for you. It's for me.
Well, but if it's for me, then I think that why would he make a piece for me where my intent of it was very clear references to things that I implicitly should know, like about movies. There were all of these things about Marilyn Monroe and Elizabeth Taylor and but in a mixed up, it was this kind of high low, kind of cool, you know, mixed up.
It set it in a time period, though.
But it wasn't. It sort of post. It kept coming into the present. Right. So it didn't. It wasn't just in that period. It kind of.
Right. I'm sorry. Let me. More than one time period. In other words, it was specifically doing that. Now I'm here.
It does jump, but then that's what the Musée Imaginaire does as well. So it's a layering back into, I guess, because it's the periodicity. It's a black and white film. It's Malraux in a moment. But then, as we say, so many of the references are to art and movies and popular culture, right up to last week.
If you knew nothing about Malraux, you never heard of him. And you don't know any of the references, do you think it would still have meaning? Or not just have meaning, but would you find meaning in it? Would you appreciate it if you knew nothing of what the references were?
Maybe not as much as one could if one did, but I mean, that's true of anything, isn't it? I mean, if you didn't know that Rand was based on Macbeth, you'd still find it an entertaining movie.
I think it's a great question. I actually think it's a great question, and I can only answer it from my own person. And it kind of gets back to the question you were asking about the Ardline show. So, and I could happily contrast them because I thought, oh, what's it up to now? And I walked in there and I thought, I'm going to hate this thing. And I loved it from the beginning. And I know almost nothing about Malraux. I understand it as I understood that image as like a picture of my cat that helps me make a piece of artwork, right? It's not really about my cat, it's about something else, but that's the way in. And so for him, I felt like that was the way in. And the way that I've been trying to describe it on the panel is specifically not to talk about those things that you're bringing up as frustrating, because I understand that frustration. But I got a ton out of that, and I didn't have to read, like, I could go find out more about Malraux. I could do all of that. I was utterly engaged. However, I did get a lot of the references, especially to pop culture. But what I was engaged with was the intensity of the delivery, the actor, person, artist, and what he was grappling with. And I could get enough of it that was enough.
I have a lot of lines that made me chuckle and I thought, oh, that's actually a beautiful, brilliant line. I'll remember that and recite it to the panel, and now I've forgotten all of them. Now, whether that's just a sign of my limited intellect, whether that's actually a sign of the quality of the things, because it had a little bit of the poetic quality of what's over Jeremy Blake soundtrack. That it was, there's this thing now in, well, he's died a few years ago, but there's this thing in relatively contemporary video and maybe art house movies as well, where we get this poetic overlay of soundtrack that half has to do with what's going on in the screen, and half really just doesn't. And the fact that, you know, the screen can go, it can go black, there are these, and also these stiffening of the, I don't know the technical term, but when the image almost freezes, but it's clearly intentional because the voice continues, these ellipses within the projection. It seems a kind of rich poetic stew. I do concur that it's awfully pretentious in places, but we need a bit of pretentious art. We've got plenty of art that's dumbed down, especially in the popular culture. That a little bit of, gosh, I wish I knew more about the history of movies or the history of art, isn't such a bad thing almost.
I felt that also kind of deflated it seriously. Like that pretentiousness made me laugh. Oh my God, right. You know, that makes it a little bit funny, almost like it's poking a little bit of fun at itself.
Yeah.
And it's not that.
did you feel that its pretentiousness was always in earnest, Philip, or did you feel it was self-ironic?
Now that I'm thinking about it, I didn't find it all that pretentious, to be honest with you. But I mean, I'm happy to admit that there were a lot of things that I didn't know. But I don't mind going back and thinking of, like, looking something up or like thinking about a reference. And I don't understand why the art has to be this. Why it can't be like that? I like that complexity. I like, and yeah. You know what?
What would you look up? I mean, how would you even know what to look up unless you?
When he talks about the general, right? He takes the general, and then I was like, oh, who's the general? And then you go around and a little bit and think about it. And of course, then you look at back at Dennis Adams' work, and you think about Algeria, and then it's De Gaulle, and then he says he takes De Gaulle, right? He takes the general, and he takes him by the hand and leads him through the Louvre, and just like. Boyce told Dürer that he was going to take Bader-Meinhof through the documenta. Yeah, that's very insular, but at the same time, it's a different kind of dialogue. It's a different kind of way of looking at something, and you know what? Thank God it is.
Also, it's not just
Because otherwise we really come to a point where, I don't know, why not have that depth? I really appreciate that.
I wish
that.
I could agree that it was depth. I mean, I actually think that it was very superficial in that way. I mean, it was masquerading as depth because it was all these deep, elite references, but what did it really say? Like, what did you take away from it? I mean, it didn't say anything to me other than, like a string of associations.
No, I don't think so. I think it was a string of references. Yes. Often contradictory, often ambiguous, but I think by design, so.
Yeah, I think that, there's now coming back to me a line where he talks about somebody was phoning in the something about some, say, Bridget Bardot, it was Jean Seaborg, boom, 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 on to the FBI, on, and then it said DSK's stolen cell phone. So it's a humorous reference, but it's a reference that it clearly can't be Malraux, obviously. So I think I think where the seriousness behind the humour lies is in this sense of fragments short against our ruin, that the page is spread out and him walking on the art, and it's about aura. It's very Benjamin. It's also very Warburg.
Right.
It's Warburg not working because there's no iconology, because it's just we're walking all over and it's spread out.
And how ironic to infuse a project that's basically about the de-auratization of art, right? It's all images, right? It's kind of the leveling, right? The democratization of the image, of the object, to instill that, as Malraux did, with this kind of persona that then Adams somewhat takes out of it again. My favorite line was something about kids these days, they have too much money, they go to fucking Istanbul, and they make some sort of pretentious art within socio-political context. School context, it's all about the autonomy art. You know, there was like, suddenly, that was almost as if there was some sort of a revelation about Malraux's, or is it Adams' attitude towards this kind of project. I like those kind of projects. So it was surprising to me that within this Adams project, and he is somebody who makes, or, you know, is close to a certain kind of art, but it's not the same. I don't know. There was a lot of good stuff there.
Well, audience, two rich shows to comment on, to stick up for, to probe. We had Ina Swansea at Blocks Gallery, and Andre Nalder's shoes at the University of the Arts. So, we'll take it as it comes, whichever show you want to comment on is fine. Yes.
Two questions. One, to just continue with this last comment towards Ariel. It seems like you're almost against sort of multiple different experiences with art. Like, I'm just going off some of your comments here. It's like, does it have to be a purely aesthetic response? And like Philip said, like, don't you find it interesting sort of going back and if you're not like learning new things or, you know?
No, I didn't think that in this particular case. It just seemed to me like it was a sort of free associative rant that you could have substituted each of the high culture references. You could have put in like hip hop references and it would have been exactly the same. Like, I didn't think that the references signified. Like, I didn't find, like, the thing that you were talking about, this sort of string of things from, you know, Brigitte Bardot to Elizabeth Taylor to Jean Seberg or whatever, and then to the cell phone, like, well, I could follow my own chain of associations, like, those are his. I didn't feel like there was any thread that tied it together that I could discern. It just seemed like a random, highbrow references that, you know, you were supposed to be clued in that it was, you know, this is high culture. Like, you're looking at high culture now. This is not like that low stuff that you'll see on YouTube. Like, now you're going to see high art. And the whole context spoke about that, and I just felt like it didn't deliver because it didn't really say anything ultimately deep to me. I'm not against art having an intellectual dimension. I didn't think this one had it, at least in a way that I could.
You're against art having a pseudo-intellectual dimension.
Yes.
Right.
Which is how I read it.
Hold your second question, and let's take, we'll come back to you, but let's hear some other voices. Anybody, other questions on both shows, or comments on both shows? Yes, there's something towards the back.
I haven't seen the Adams piece, but just based off of maybe their characterization.
Could you use the mic so we can all hear you?
I'm using it, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'm kind of wondering if it's totally off base, but this sort of Adams fan fiction of Melrose, like, might be, like, that is as you would might be able to indulge both these references and even, like, that for being able to give a bit of pleasure and maybe accounting for taste and maybe some of the other picking up on pop culture references. So maybe the notion of a fan, this is a fan fiction. So I don't know if that's like grossly reductive or possibly, like,
That sounds like it's a point of view. Yeah.
Are you saying that he chose to do that because he loves Mel Rowe and he wanted to live through him? Is that what you said? Fan fiction.
Are you guys fan fiction? I mean, I don't.
Give us a definition of fan fiction. It sounds like I ought to know it.
I think it's more.
Take the mic back, will you?
So maybe what I'm most familiar encountering with would be like for a particular show or comic book character, something so like Superman fan fiction, where
Is it really like Frederick Tutin writing Tintin in the New World, where you're a fan of a fictional character or a real character who's out there in the world, and you take them and you put them in the center of your novel?
Right, but then treating, like, in real history, a real person with his past, with all these other associations, and sort of freely, rewriting or proposing this other situation or scenario that might be based off of true events, but engaging both Adams as the maker and this other person's story in life. Mm-hmm. And maybe that is a piece, allowing the ghost of Adams to kind of, like, you know, in a world where Adams has a cell phone, or in a world where, so maybe just opening, that just being a different vehicle, different format. So maybe I was thinking, like, this film, this video, characterizing it a little differently.
That was my take on it, so I totally agree with you. I mean, I think that Adams is channeling, is creating a character that may be more Adams than Malraux, and funneling it into a sort of semi-fictional recreation, starting with a classic photograph of Malraux himself. So, because I mean, in particular, the sexuality aspect that keeps coming up. You mentioned the general, there's one line where he says, the general is looking at the spine, the backsides of some soldiers who are about to meet infinity and blah, blah, blah. And lots of questions where Malraux is, moments where Malraux is wringing his hands and being questioned about his sexuality or about sexuality in the art and so on. It seemed to me there's a thick subplot there that's probably doesn't come out of Malraux per se. I don't know enough about Malraux's sex life, but I suspect not. So that would be, I think, an example of fan fiction.
You know, there's a lot of hangers in this audience, and I'm wondering why they aren't saying anything about Ina Swanson.
Oh, excellent. let's have question number two. Excellent, thank you.
I wanted to know, and to the effect of a lot of Philadelphia fans, I guess, here, did anyone sort of tap into, not to bring another exhibition into it, but Sarah McAleenan's downstairs, and a Philadelphia artist doing Philadelphia landscapes, a New York artist doing New York landscapes in probably the most prominent gallery in Philadelphia. Any sort of thoughts, comments, ideas in regards to that? Did that sort of, anyone even think about that? Or?
No, that's definitely, I mean, I think we could definitely, if we had the time and space to have more and more shows, I mean, a comparison that has been, it gives a very startling juxtaposition, isn't it? Any feelings, Ariella, coming from New York, and on McEnany in comparison to?
I love that show. I think it's so great.
Not to focus on McEnany, but even more so to focus on, and I wanted to actually hear a comment, as being from New York, you also being from New York, seeing, you know, New York artists doing landscapes of New York being shown in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I feel that I'm a big fan of McEnany, and I've written about her. In fact, we covered her in the New York Review panel in one of its early instances, and I think she's a lovely, wonderful artist. There's a superb handling of materials. She's got a very distinct personal language, but it's one that's high art and has a kind of folk art. Sort of outsidery feel as well. I think she's. I think those are timeless images of Philly, and I think you know, all power to her elbow. I have to say, in absolute sincerity, that when I see her on one floor and Swansea on a higher floor, that's symbolic for me. I mean, I think that Swansea is a much more intellectually ambitious painter, and I think that I feel that McEnany has her language, and she paints her world in her language, and that Swansea is grappling with sort of the underlying meanings of language, and that her motifs feed into that that struggle, that inquiry, and it just puts it intellectually on a very different level. But you know, I think one can have different qualities of experience, and one can enjoy things on their own terms. And I enjoy McEnany, but I think Swansea's among the more interesting artists around today. So they're just a different order for me. It's not about being landscapes of New York or landscapes of Philadelphia. I think it's McEnany's world, and I think it's Swansea's investigation of the language of painting. Come on, shoot me down. Well, I hate to be immodest enough to have the last word, but I feel it is 8 o'clock and we've covered a lot of ground. Thank you very much.